First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
Florida school districts battle the state over masks and COVID, but they might be changing their policy soon as the case count ticks down. That's some good news. Good Monday morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead this hour, could that mask mandate soon be optional in the Duval schools? We are taking a look at what we might expect this week. Give us a call, 549-2937. Then later, what might be the fate of Jaguars coach Urban Meyer after scandal, and now one of the worst losing streaks in the NFL? That's later. But first this hour, the Duval County School Board has a discussion set for today on whether they'll continue with a mask mandate for both students and staff. Now, Duval Schools has continued to defy the state in mandating masks for students. They've joined five other districts around Florida in suing the Florida Department of Health, filing a legal challenge over state rules prohibiting mask restrictions for students. What's the latest on this? Well, we're pleased to welcome attorney Jamie Allen Cole. He's representing the six districts in court. He's a partner at Weiss, Sirota, Heifman, Cole, and Bierman, and he's on the line. Jamie, good morning.
Good morning.
Good to have you on the show. All right, everybody. We are talking masks again. Yes, you might be tired of masks. I think we all are. But Duval Schools has a hearing on this today. They might change their policy. Could there be some light at the end of the tunnel? Give us a call, 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. So, Jamie, the Duval County Schools might make the mask mandate for students optional after this week if they get a look at the case count across Duval County and decide that it's safe enough now to make masks optional for students. We'll have to wait and see what happens with that. In the meantime, your complaint is going forward. You're representing Duval County and six other school districts around Florida. Bring us up to date on this matter, and what are the next steps?
Thank you. We have a final hearing scheduled for October 21st. So the final hearing is going to start a week from Thursday. This is for all six districts, which encompass and serve over 800,000 students. And it doesn't deal only with masks. Their rule goes beyond masks. I mean, it does provide that parents have the right in their sole discretion to opt their children out of the mask mandate. It also has a provision on quarantine. So if a student is exposed to COVID, the rule says the parent has the right to send the child to school. The parent does not have to have the child tested, and the school, even for the exposed student, cannot require that student to wear a mask. So there's issues here that go a little bit beyond just the mask.
Yeah. Yeah, the quarantine issue is such a deeply felt issue for parents. They are being so directly impacted by this. But this is really about whether a school board has local control, has home rule, and whether the Department of Health can issue rules about parental rights. These six districts, Duval, Alachua, Broward, Leon, Miami-Dade, have all banded together on this complaint, and they're basically saying the state is wrong and their rule is invalid and they don't need to follow it, according to the challenge, correct?
That is correct, that the rulemaking authority of the Department of Health is limited to rules that control communicable diseases. So they certainly can issue a rule that would control communicable diseases, but this rule doesn't. I mean, what this rule does is kind of the opposite. It says school districts cannot have policies that control communicable diseases and have to let parents opt to have situations that are even more likely to spread COVID. Yeah, so it is an interesting question, parental rights versus government rights, and it comes up all the time. Mm-hmm. And there's obviously parental rights are crucial and parents have the right to raise their children and make decisions and healthcare decisions. But at the same time, you know, a parent doesn't have the right to expose other children to communicable diseases. So there's a balancing that has to take place, but the role of that balancing should be done at the local level, because every community, as you mentioned, Duval, you know, may be considering making changes in their policy. A lot of the school districts are looking very closely at the data to see if they can lift or modify some of these restrictions, and hopefully they can. That certainly would be best for everyone.
They might do that this week. They're going to take a look at the case count, the rolling positive rates, the number of cases per 100,000 people in this county. What about, now this isn't part of your complaint, Jamie, but what about the fact that the state Board of Education approved Education Commissioner Richard Corcoran's request to actually withhold state funding equal to school board members' salaries plus whatever amount the federal government contributes to make up for that, financially penalizing Duval County Public Schools and other districts around the state for enforcing a mass mandate and enforcing protocols to reduce the spread of COVID-19?
Well, it's a bit scary when the government, or the state government, is trying to penalize local officials for doing what they think is best. And here, the Board of Education can't just fine the school board members. They can't just fine them an amount equal to their salary. So what they're doing is they're indirectly trying to accomplish that same result. And the government is not allowed to do indirectly what it can't do directly. So if they're not allowed to fine the school board members, they certainly aren't allowed to withhold money from the school board in an amount equal to their salary and basically tell the school district they shouldn't pay the salaries. Now, as far as the amount offsetting for the federal government, you know, I guess that's an issue between the state and the federal government. And it raises some very interesting questions. There are some federal laws that are implicated that do suggest that that's not permissible, but that's really between the federal government and the state government.
If districts like Duval relax their mandates this week, that does not affect your legal action. Let's make sure people are clear on that. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, unfortunately, COVID is not completely over. And as we've seen, it goes up and down. We're in a surge, or we're at the end of a surge or a wave right now, but most likely, unfortunately, there'll be another one at some point. So we do think that this issue needs to be resolved, whether or not local school districts are going to be able to have local control. If in their county, cases go back up, positivity rates go back up. So It is an interesting legal question as to how this will play out if all of the school districts were to change their policies in a way that fully comply with the order. But it's not looking like the cases have come down sufficiently for all six of the districts to do that.
549-2937. Give us a call this Monday morning. Bill in St. Augustine. Hi, Bill.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. How are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic.
Good to hear it.
Question. It's more of a statement. Getting back to those who don't remember history are doomed to repeat it. Are these people not remembering that we had a mask mandate, had a lockdown a little more than a year ago, and then lightened it up, and then everything came back? Why do this now? Why not wait until we have COVID under control? Because we don't.
Yeah. Thanks, Bill. You know, Jamie, the majority of parents, according to polling, support keeping these measures in place until they feel it's safe to relax them. A loud minority of parents really doesn't like these mandates, and they've let boards of education know that all over America. But what about Bill's point?
Well, you know, I think both sides have some very good points. I mean, I understand the parents who feel that it should be up to them what happens to their child. I'm a parent. My children are older, but I can certainly understand how they feel. But at the same time, there are situations that come up where government does have to step in and require things, such as, you know, we require car seats. You know, we require kids playing football to wear helmets. You know, there's things that, you know, parents can't just say, you know, my kid's going to play high school football, but he's not going to wear a helmet. It just, there are certain things that just have to times where the parental rights have to give in for safety and health reasons. And the Parental Bill of Rights that was passed by the legislature recognizes that. It's not an unlimited right. It is limited, and the local government school board districts are allowed to have measures that infringe on parental rights if they're necessary to a compelling state interest, like fighting COVID would be.
I will be interested to see how the judge, hearing your argument, rules on this later this month. In the meantime, 549-2937, Rusty on the West Side. Hi, Rusty.
Hi, Melissa. Good morning.
Good morning.
Masks have been, tremendously beneficial, arguably have saved countless lives. However, I saw a soundbite recently with a mom of a small child, and she described what was going on with the masks at that school. So it dawned on me, rather than Tallahassee politics or even the local school board, you know, the school is kind of a self-contained unit and can be made even more so with some controls. Why not give power to the principal and the assistant principals and let them kind of, you know, have a policy? They can see what's going on at the school every day. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Rusty. You know, that's the argument for home rule, local control. Typically, it doesn't, these kinds of decisions, Jamie, don't go to the individual principal, but rather to a school district. But in this case, the state is telling school districts they don't have the power to make those decisions.
That's correct. And, you know, I think Rusty makes a good point. I think the problem with having it at the individual school district is there's really not data at the individual school district. Positivity rates are reported countywide. Case rates are countywide. It'd be very tricky to figure out the data, and I'm not sure every single principal is in a position to have medical experts available giving them data. For example, Miami-Dade County School District, they had a healthcare task force that studied COVID and made recommendations to the board. Individual principals would never have the ability to do that. So although I think it's, you know, an interesting idea to let each school principal do it, I think it probably has to be done district-wide.
Mm. And you know, let's be clear, these districts that you're representing that are suing or taking legal action collectively, they have purview over the majority of the children in Florida. These are most of the large urban school districts across the state. This is most of the kids in the state you're representing in court, correct?
I don't know the total number of students statewide in all 67 counties, but this is over 800,000 students.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think if it's not most, it's close to it.
549-2937, Dennis in Ponte Vedra. Hi, Dennis.
Hey, how are you guys?
Great. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Good. I'm just curious as to whether the stance has changed on the large part of the population that had COVID and dealt with it really well and got over it and formed natural immunity. And so I'm trying to find out if the stance has changed for those people as to should they get the vaccine. I, of course, am vaccinated, but should those people get the vaccine if they know what their immune system did having COVID before and after the vaccine has been available? So what I'm asking is, has the stance changed on the people that have had COVID and said, hey, I'm fine with this even when it becomes a seasonal illness,
mm-hmm.
and I don't mind getting it again? Has the stance changed on those people?
Yeah, you know, Dennis, we don't have a doctor on the show today, but you know what, Jamie, it's my understanding that the doctors we've interviewed have said even if you've had the virus and recovered, you should still get vaccinated because immunity from the vaccine is stronger and longer lasting than immunity from having the disease. I believe that's the medical advice, Jamie.
I believe that's the medical advice as well. That's what I've heard from all the experts that I've spoken with. It's a little beyond the scope of our issue in this lawsuit, but yes, that is my understanding as well.
549-2937, Richie in Jacksonville. Hi, Richie.
Hello, how you doing?
Great.
Yeah, I have an idea. I prefer my child not to wear a mask. And the idea I came up with was, why would school come up with an idea, for example, where half the school that's vaccinated, they're in one part of the school, separate them. And then we could do an experiment, and we can have real data. We can have one side of the school is not vaccinated, and they don't want to wear a mask, and that's their choice. And then one school is vaccinated, and they want to wear a mask, and you go on the other side of the school, and we'll see who does better at the end of the year.
Well, you know what, Richie? I've heard those arguments, and school districts have shot them down because they know that would only open them up to even more litigation, unfortunately. And Jamie, you can take that as the attorney in this conversation.
Sure. Well, first of all, in K through 8, there's really not that option.
Because yeah, no vaccine available yet. Yeah.
But I will mention in Leon County, for example, for K through 8, everyone has to wear masks unless there's a medical reason. And then for high school, where kids, you know, can be vaccinated, parents can opt out for any reason. So it's kind of similar to what he was saying. However,
but by age,
right. The Department of Health rule will not allow it. I mean, the way the rule is drafted, a school district that wanted to do that would not be allowed to do it. It would still violate the rule.
What Richie described was something like a COVID-19 Hunger Games. In the sense that, and I'm not trying to denigrate Richie at all, but just saying that, you know, if you are putting one control group of kids in one area and another just to see how it turns out, you're exposing kids, some kids more than others. And let's be clear, COVID is killing kids and making kids sick as easily as adults. No. But this virus is a danger to children. There are kids in our local ICU. And Jamie, you know, the vaccine for kids age 5 to 11, the Pfizer vaccine, is on the way. Parents are anxiously awaiting that want to vaccinate their children. But in the meantime, the reason this issue is so fraught for the younger grades, as you say, is because kids under 12 are not yet eligible to be vaccinated. And parents are fearful sending their kid to school with nothing but a mask for protection. And they're watching those case counts very closely.
Yeah, I think that's correct. And even after the vaccine is approved for that age group, there are a lot of parents that are going to be hesitant to have their children vaccinated. You know, they may be willing to get vaccinated themselves, but it's their children, and they may be even more hesitant. So until the vaccination rate gets high enough, I don't think the situation would really change. I mean, the CDC guideline is still, even for vaccinated people, to wear masks indoors where there's lots of people, mm-hmm. like schools.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's this is something that I think parents are so weary of. Because, of course, the quarantine issue is another big piece of your action in court. Whether parents who have an asymptomatic child should quarantine their child if they've been exposed to COVID-19, or whether they should send the child to school. The state says send the child to school. Districts want to continue, some of them anyway, the quarantine policies that they've set forth. Can you talk a little bit more about this piece of the matter?
Right. Well, I think one question right off the top is, you know, what does it mean to have a student be asymptomatic? You know, if a parent has a child who has allergies and is sniffling, the parent, you know, and has been exposed to COVID, how do you know whether the child is symptomatic or not? There's certain, you know, if the parents are going to be deciding if the child is symptomatic or not, that raises all types of other questions. You know, I think a lot of the school districts want to start easing the quarantine because in-person schooling is just so much better than remote schooling. And all the school districts want, I mean, they want the kids in place in school, but at the same time, you can't be risking their health and safety. So there's some districts that want to stop the quarantining, but if a kid is exposed, they want them to wear a mask. The real danger of this emergency rule is that it combines those two things. So if the child is exposed, the parent can send them to school or her to school and not wear a mask. That makes no sense.
Sten is on the line. Sten, how are you today?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, I have a comment on the asymptomatic and then a question for the lawyer. Asymptomatic is the wrong thing to be looking at. Science tells us that people spread the disease most before they show any symptoms. And it also shows that many people show no symptoms and still have the disease and spread it. So whether or not a person is showing symptoms does not tell you whether or not they can spread the disease. Now, a legal question. I don't understand what the authority is for any of the state government to penalize a school board for doing something they don't like. Well, that seems to me just to be a bullying action. I don't even understand why it should be legal.
Thank you for that.
Why can the state do that?
Yeah, I think that's the question that the courts will answer eventually. Jamie.
Yes, well, first on the asymptomatic issue, I think you're 100% correct. The problem is the Department of Health does not agree. And the Department of Health has said that if a student is asymptomatic, even if he or she is exposed to COVID, the school district has to let them come back to school and not even wear a mask. So I think your point is 100% correct. On the legal authority to fine individual school board members, like they're kind of indirectly doing, there is absolutely zero authority to do that. The state does have the authority to withhold funds to a school district if they're violating a law, and they're viewing this emergency rule as a law, and they're viewing their action to be taken under that provision. I personally do not think it falls under that provision, and I don't think they have the authority to do it, and it's an issue that will ultimately be resolved, but I completely agree with you that it is totally inappropriate for the state to be penalizing local school board members who are just trying to do their job and do the best they can to protect the health, safety, and welfare of their children.
Jake on the north side. Hi, Jake.
Yes, I would like to make a comment, and I'm off the air.
Okay.
I would like to see our city council take back some of that grant money that they got recently and give it to school board members so they can stand up to the state, and that the city council members ought to fill in the gaps about trash pickup by getting on the back of some of these trash trucks. Excuse me.
Yeah, Jake, I hear your frustration and I appreciate the call. You know, there are other issues going on here, Jamie. You're not living in Jacksonville. We're not getting our recycling picked up. The Jacksonville City Council is in a pickle because there's been a lot of criticism about the way they're doling out COVID grant money to local nonprofits without much vetting or oversight. There's this issue in the schools. And so, you know, when it comes to governance, both local and state, there's a lot of frustration right now. And I think you heard that in Jake's voice. But can you, let's end then with letting people know where this goes next.
Okay, well, the next step will be the final hearing, which will be October 21st and 22nd, where the administrative law judge will decide whether or not the Department of Health rule violates, is an invalid exercise of rulemaking authority. I suspect that is not the end of the day. That would most likely, no matter who wins, will be appealed to a district court of appeal, theoretically even to the Florida Supreme Court, but hopefully not. Hopefully it'll end at the district court of appeal level. But you know, this is an ongoing battle between local control and state control over this issue and how, you know, parental rights versus health. So these are very big policy issues. They're difficult issues. There's difficult legal issues, but you know, we will get through them, and hopefully COVID cases will go down substantially and positivity rates will go down. And, you know, in 2 or 3 or 4 weeks, we'll be at a point that we won't need mask mandates or anything of this sort.
Let's hope for that. My gosh. Thank you so much, Attorney Jamie Allen Cole, for being with us.
Thank you.
And much more still ahead later. Jaguars fans ponder the fate of coach Urban Meyer after the team loses again, this time to the Titans. But up next.
also, as part of that 45th year anniversary recognition, Michael Ward Foundation, along with his wife, also gave $1 million, pledged $1 million for over 4 years. So that is really incredible.
It's Domestic Violence Awareness Month. A look at the vital role of Hubbard House after this.
WJCT Public Media is bringing you a new healthcare show, What's Health Got to Do with It? Our goal is to help you navigate all things health and healthcare and get you the answers you deserve. Join me, Dr. Joe Servin, Saturdays at 4 p.m. and Sundays at 9 p.m. on WJCT News 89.9. Sponsored in part by American Brain Foundation, Epilepsy Foundation, and Norellis.
Welcome back. Well, this region's premier domestic violence shelter, Hubbard House, is out with the results of their 2020 domestic violence fatality report. Last year in Duval County, there were 14 domestic violence-related deaths. 8 of them were specifically related to intimate partner violence. October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and Hubbard House recently received a $1 million grant to help victims and also raise awareness about intimate partner violence. I spoke with their CEO, Gail Patton. So, Gail, tell us, if you could, begin with the good news as we mark Domestic Violence Awareness Month. Some good news for Hubbard House, yeah?
Well, the good news, a couple of things. We are recognizing our 45th anniversary. So for 45 years, Hubbard House has been saving lives and changing lives. And then also as part of that 45th year anniversary recognition, Michael Ward Foundation, along with his wife, also gave $1 million, pledged $1 million for over 4 years. So that is really incredible.
That is great because the need is there. You just put out a report about domestic violence in Duval County for 2020, and it remains a serious issue. Can you talk about that and how this money will help in your efforts?
Absolutely. So we did do a report recently, and it's a report we've been doing for well over 20 years now, where we look at the fatalities of the prior year due to domestic violence. And what we are finding out, as in last year, but it's been a trend through the decades, is that guns continue to be the main killer of victims of domestic violence, and that it is disproportionately impacting women as the victims, and that the people who are dying are not the people who have reached out to Hubbard House for help. So what that tells us is the more we get the message out, people that are getting to us for help are not the ones who are dying. So it really inspires us to continue to get the message out, to let them know, to call us if they need help. Certainly if you're in a situation that is immediately dangerous, call JSO. But, you know, reach out and get that help because that could literally save a life.
You looked at fatalities for Duval County, and we're talking about intimate partner violence that leads to homicide. Husbands, wives, boyfriends, girlfriends. That's really at the heart of this, isn't it?
Correct. Now, we do review every single domestic violence case, and there were 14 last year. Of the 14, 8 were intimate partner domestic violence, but of those 8, 2 were actually women who were fighting back. They were protecting themselves, and both those were ruled justifiable homicides because they had been victims for years and years of somebody who had broken to their home and tried to perpetrate against them.
Wow.
So we are still seeing that the majority of the deaths due to domestic violence is intimate partner. And, you know, it's sobering to do this study year after year, and it's sobering to understand that we still need to get that message out there. One woman was stabbed 111 times. I mean, that is just horrific to think that people are living in that kind of fear and with that kind of level of lethality.
with the donation that you've received, how will that help Hubbard House provide support and help for people who have suffered this kind of intimate partner violence?
Well, it is just wonderful to have the support from the Michael Ward and Jennifer Glock Foundation. And how it helps is that it ensures that services continue. It ensures that the shelter stays open. It ensures that we, you know, have our advocates who are the ones who are doing the legwork with all the victims. You know, they're the ones who are answering the phones. They're the ones who are meeting with them at our outreach center. They're the ones who are meeting with them at the courts to help them safety plan, to help them understand what their options are. Without this type of support from Michael Ward and Jennifer Glock, and without the support we get from the community, we couldn't do this type of work. So it all adds towards reaching that person who needs it the most, for them and for their children.
And, you know, going beyond the incredible work you do at Hubbard House, Gail, as we talk about Domestic Violence Awareness Month, you mentioned it's depressing to roll out these statistics year after year. Isn't the deeper answer that we just need cultural change? We need an end to gender-based violence. We need an end to domestic violence. We need to change the way we raise our children so that, honestly, you're at one day put out of a job.
You know, Melissa, that is absolutely correct. I actually said that yesterday at our annual breakfast, that I believe that one day we can have no domestic violence in our communities. And part of what you're talking about, that social change, that is part of our mission. Not only do we provide safety and empowerment for victims, but we also work on social change so that we can get to the root of violence so that, you know, one day we won't have it anymore. There won't be a need for a Hubbard House. And so we work on all levels of intervention and prevention, and which is why we do our community education out in the community. We go and let people know about domestic violence so that they can help a friend or family members. We do training with kids in middle school and high school to let them know about it. And then also we do primary prevention, where we just meet with children and we talk about gender-based violence and try to get rid of some of those stereotypes that put people in one category or the other. So it is a continual work that all of us have to do in this society to make that big change.
Gail Patton, you do such amazing work in this community, and congratulations on the new donation. Gail Patton is CEO of Hubbard House, a full-service certified domestic violence center in Jacksonville. Thanks, Gail.
Thank you for getting the word out, Melissa.
Lounge Radio around the clock. Allow the sounds of chill out, down tempo, new jazz, and reggae to relax and inspire you. Download the WJCT app or visit wjct.org/jacksmusic to start listening today.
Well, she's a gun violence survivor and a volunteer with the Florida chapter of Moms Demand Action. Jacksonville resident Crystal Turner lost both her son and her daughter to gun violence. It happened when her daughter's estranged husband murdered them both. Today, Crystal's focus is on domestic violence and its links to the growing use of guns by abusers. I spoke with her about Moms Demand as we continue marking Domestic Violence Awareness Month. Hey, Crystal, good to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Melissa.
And I'm interested to talk to you about Domestic Violence Awareness Month in the context of gun violence and gun safety. Tell us a little bit about your story so that people can first become familiar with what drew you to this movement, if you could.
Sure. April 1st, 2015, my life changed. I am a mother of four adult children, and on that day, we all got up and went to work. And at 11:30, we took a lunch break. And at 12 noon, I received a phone call from an employee stating that two of my adult children, my daughter Janaea, who was 29 at the time, and my son Donnell, who was 23 at that time, had both been shot and killed by my daughter Janaea's estranged husband, Roy. And that began a new life, and the work that I now do as an advocate against domestic violence and gun violence as well.
And I'm so sorry that you suffered that tragedy. I can't even imagine the pain that you went through as a mom. And so you grieved the loss of your children, and then you became involved in raising awareness about the link between domestic violence and its connection to the abuse of guns by abusive people in this country. So you're a domestic violence survivor, but it's a gun-related incident. Can you talk about this and how big of a problem this is in America?
Sure. You know, like most people, unfortunately, when we think about domestic violence, we think about it in the past tense after it has happened to someone, after it has appeared on the news, and we're now seeing all of the heartful thoughts and prayers, and we're sending those to families. However, when we think about domestic violence as a whole, we think about the number of men and women who have lost their lives to domestic violence, especially intimate partner relationships. We know that domestic violence, as defined by the law, is anyone that is biologically or emotionally related to you. So domestic violence can also show up in the form of children against parents, parents against children, siblings, all of those things. But most commonly, we do see it as intimate partner relationships. And when we think about intimate partner relationships, again, we're thinking about the abused woman who we've seen over the years with the black eye and all of those sorts of things. However, now, unfortunately, domestic violence shows up in an entirely different way. A lot of the domestic violence that we see today is emotional. When we think about the fact that right now we have been living through a pandemic and that we have a lot more abusers and victims still staying in the same home together. And so we're seeing a rise in those numbers as well. In terms of victims and abusers on both sides, we're seeing a lot more of gun-related deaths that are occurring due to domestic violence, in part domestic violence abusers and their victims being in the same household.
You're a survivor of gun violence. You're also involved in the with the Florida chapter of Moms Demand Action. This organization has started to see success in pressing forward with common sense gun safety proposals. Tell us more about that.
One of the several key things that we're fighting and that we've been winning very small battles and climbing some great mountains with is the universal background checks. And simply say universal background checks allows sellers of guns to make sure before someone purchases that gun that we are doing that background check to make sure that that person criminally does not have any criminal past that prohibits them from owning a gun. But more importantly, it gives that waiting period there. And sometimes in cases such as mine, my son-in-law would have passed because there was no previous convictions for him. But with the universal background check combined with the red flag law, my daughter wouldn't have been able to go into a court of law and say, based on their previous history of the physical and mental abuse that was happening in their home, that this person would not have been a candidate to be able to purchase a gun.
Yeah, and
that could, she would have felt that her life would have been more.
Her life would have been in danger. Can you explain, yes, for those that aren't familiar, what red flag laws are?
What red flag laws are? Red flag laws are simply, we're asking states to think about when we have individuals in our family who may be dealing with mental issues, such as maybe PTSD. When we think about our, again, domestic and intimate partners or even our children's in terms of gun ownership, and maybe they've said unfortunate things like, you know, I don't want to be here, or they threaten to kill others or themselves. Well, the red flag law would then allow individuals like myself or other family members or even those in our community, such as our police officers, officers of the court, to go into a court and ask the judge to say, maybe, for example, be able to say, we know this individual has a gun. However, there has been cases of domestic violence in the home, and we're asking that the gun be removed from the home for a period of time until the courts can do a review and an assessment of the individual in the home, which would then save a life. Another example would be, again, if we are aware that we may have a family member who is dealing with severe PTSD and they have multiple guns in the home, again, we could go into the court and say, hey, you know, this is what's going on, and for the safety of that individual, of keeping them their self safe as well as others, we're asking for the court to simply remove the gun for a period of time until, again, a review can be done to evaluate to make sure that the person who has that gun is emotionally and mentally competent.
Yeah, and these laws have gained traction in a number of states, not Florida yet, of course.
Correct.
But I want to thank you, Crystal Turner of Jacksonville, involved with the local chapter of Moms Demand Action as we talk about Domestic Violence Awareness Month. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
In a moment, what will be Urban Meyer's fate as the Jaguars lose again? Sports analyst Josh Torres up next.
Lee and Kate's Glass, family-owned and operated for 95 years. Lee and Kate's Glass is your source for upgrading your home's glass, from shower doors and mirrors to windows and tabletops. Learn more at leeandkatesglass.com.
ServPro Jacksonville South and Arlington Jacksonville East reminds you, water damage happens fast. The Weather Center predicts an active storm season. Be prepared with emergency numbers. 721-2230. ServPro Jacksonville South and Arlington Jacksonville East. Like it never even happened.
The Jacksonville Symphony's spectacular fall season continues with performances of Bach's lively Brandenburg Concerto No. 1, performed for you in Jacoby Symphony Hall, October 22nd and 23rd. Treat yourself to a sensational evening of live classical music, a night out to be shared with family and friends. Tickets and information at jacksymphony.org.
The Parliament House Resort in Orlando was a center for LGBTQ plus culture from 1975 through 2020. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll discuss the Parliament House Resort. We'll read some mid-19th century letters and talk about endangered African-American cemeteries. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on WJCT News 89.9.
Has Facebook gone too far?
My name is Frances Haugen. I used to work at Facebook. I'm here today because I believe Facebook's products harm children, stoke division, and weaken our democracy.
Congress is being urged to act, but how should we respond? How are some of you already responding? That story and your stories on the next 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, the Jaguars lost again yesterday, now putting the team into one of the worst losing streaks in NFL history. And Coach Urban Meyer is also continuing to deal with the fallout of scandal in his personal conduct. So what does this mean for Urban Meyer? Sports analyst Josh Torres was in the press box Sunday, and he has some thoughts. Hi, Josh.
Hello, Melissa.
All right. So the Jaguars are as losing a team as there possibly is, almost in NFL history. This is as bad as it gets, just about.
Last week was a very turbulent week for head coach Urban Meyer after this video came out of him last weekend. Had to apologize to the media, still facing a lot of criticism for everything that happened. And, you know, this kind of led into what a lot of people saw as a make-or-break week for him as they took on the division rivals, Tennessee Titans. First off, kicker Josh Lambeau, who has had an absolutely terrible year, was inactive. And the Jags actually turned to the kicker that they signed last week, Matthew Wright, to take on kicking duties. Him and Lambeau had a competition over the past week to decide who was going to take kicking duties this past weekend, and Matthew Wright got the job. So, you know, during the first half, the Jags offense honestly looked really pretty good. I mean, Trevor was making some really good reads, moving around the pocket, getting out of trouble and finding his players. James Robinson, this is a guy that Jags fans, media members, everybody looks at and are just like, this guy needs the ball. He needs the ball as much as possible. This is how you're going to beat teams. He ran for 1,000 yards last year, and this year everybody feels like he's just not getting the ball enough. But the one bad thing from the first half really was the Jags defense. They were just, the secondary was not doing well. They were leaving receivers wide open for on third down plays that allowed for big gains and getting touchdown passes in. The Jags eventually went into the half down 24-13. And then, you know, coming into the second half, the Jags defense actually really stepped up. The Titans scored early in the half, but the Jags defense started to kind of hold them back. Trevor ran in for a touchdown that was going to bring the game back into that did kind of bring the game back into reach for them. But ultimately, the offense just really started to slow down. They started getting really held back. Trevor got stopped short on the goal line. That brought up a big fourth and one play where, for whatever reason, and I'm sorry if I'm starting to sound like a passionate fan here.
You are. But what about Urban Meyer?
Well, let's get back to this particular play because this is really showing the coaching of this. It's a fourth and one from the goal line. They have a former 1,000-yard rusher who was averaging 8.3 yards per carry yesterday, a quarterback who's already run in for a touchdown and nearly scored his second rushing touchdown, and they didn't give the ball to either one of them. Mm-hmm. You know, they handed it off to Carlos Hyde, who, you know, I respect to Carlos Hyde. He's can make some big plays, but it just, they got stopped. He ended up losing yardage on this play, and after that, they fell, and now it is 20 straight losses. If they lost 38-19 yesterday, they're only the second team since the NFL-AFL merger to lose 20 straight games, the other being the expansion Tampa Bay Buccaneers back in from 1976 to 77.
Yeah, that's the longest streak, isn't it?
No, it is not.
What's the longest one?
It is 29 straight games for the Chicago Cardinals, a team that does not even exist anymore, who lost 29 straight games over four seasons.
Josh.
And I mean, yesterday, Yulee native Derrick Henry, who has absolutely torched the Jags over the past few seasons, was kind of held in check, but still ran for 130 yards and three touchdowns. You know, I will say Trevor is still improving. He did have one turnover in garbage time football right at the end of the game. He did throw an interception. James Robinson, again, averaging 8.3 yards per carry yesterday, set a career high in rushing yards with 149 and a touchdown. And the worst part of it is in the second half, they only gave the ball to Robinson six times, and he was averaging 8.3 yards per carry. So,
all right. But Josh, is Urban Meyer toast? That's what the only question anyone has at this point. Is he going to survive another week?
Because the Jags are getting ready to fly to London, I personally think he's going to survive at least one more week just because they're getting ready to travel. They're going to have to leave earlier this week than they usually would to get used to the London time zones and getting ready for that game that's going to be this Sunday at 9:30 against the Dolphins. But I really, really, truly think that if he does not pull out a W real quick this Sunday, he is going to be gone after next week.
And we didn't even have time to talk about college sports or golf, but you can follow Josh on Twitter at Josh as a polar bear and get all of his thoughts about the world of sports. And always good to get your insights. I got caught in the stadium traffic Sunday because I was heading downtown for something else. And I thought of you and Heather Schatz sitting up there in the press box watching the depressing game unfold.
It was.
all props to you, Josh and Heather, for being there throughout the season covering the Jaguars. Thanks.
Thank you, Melissa.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening, everybody. Thanks to Josh Torres, Heather Schatz, Catherine Hobbs, Editorial Director Jessica Palumbo, and a new addition, our news editor, Randy Roguski, to the team. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. You can catch our podcast up later today, wherever you like to listen. You can also send us your feedback, emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Have a great week, everyone. Be safe. We'll be right back here again tomorrow at 9 a.m.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.